This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Former Bloomington Mayor Steve Stockton stayed in Florida through Hurricane Irma.
That is scary. You know, being from Illinois, we're conditioned to think about when you hear those winds and the window is shaking back and forth and so on, that's a tornado. Here, that's just a normal part of a hurricane, and the true Floridians are used to that. It is scary.
Riding the storm, Colleen Reynolds has the interview, plus Bloomington Mayor Pro Tem Karen Schmidt stops by, and John Norton talks with Ronnie Baker Brooks about his music. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington residents could see a 73% increase in monthly sewer bills, and stormwater sewer bills could rise by half over 5 years. That's in a staff proposal to the City Council. Joining us after last night's council meeting is Alderman and Mayor Pro Tem Karen Schmidt to talk about what is the case for this, Karen?
Well, we are at a situation here where we don't have really more than maintenance money in our sanitary sewer fund, and really $0 for capital improvements in our stormwater fund. We've grappled with this idea over a number of years, and as we've built our capital improvement program, this has become a key part of that. So we're trying to put the numbers around that and see how much we can get done and how quickly we can get it done.
The increases would be nearly 12% annually in sewer rates, consumption fees, and more than 8% in stormwater fees. Why bundle it that way over 3 to 5 years? Why not just go all at once?
Well, we talked about that last night, and I think we'll be seeing some different models, options out of our finance department and public works. We talked quite a bit about we can't do resurfacing, significant resurfacing on streets that really need it when we know that underneath those streets there's work that needs to be done. So to do this in a responsible way and to get the biggest bang for the buck, we want to look at what will happen if we ramp this up and do this more quickly in, say, 2 to 3 years, or whether we look at it at maybe, you know, reaching a pinnacle in about 8 years and really getting done in 20 years. Which is a very long time out.
Isn't it a trifle unfair to stick today's ratepayers with all of that, though?
Well, I'm sure that there's people who would make that argument, you know, we just need to do the very best we can at this point in time. This is where we are. I know that since our city manager, David Hales, has been at the helm, we've significantly changed the way that we subsidize new development, which has taken dollars away from taking care of our infrastructure and our historic core. And that's been disadvantageous. So I'm very grateful that he's kind of turned that philosophy around, and we're slowly able to address more of our needs. Public Works has also been doing a lot of exceptional work in looking at new kinds of technology like sewer lining and that kind of thing, which has saved us quite a bit of money. So we're able to get more bang for the buck, but we know that we have, you know, years and years, decades of neglected underground infrastructure.
Is that an indictment of previous councils, administration, mayoral administrations, and city managers?
I think that this is the sort of thing that has not been on the radar in the past few decades, and you know, I really couldn't speak to the kinds of decisions that were made in the past. I just know that sitting in front of us is one that we need to make, and we need to make it you know, to improve our community.
How fast is it possible to go with available workforce and motorist needs? Some streets would be torn up for this, obviously, and that would disrupt traffic. You've got to be careful as to how much you tear up all at once.
Right.
How fast is it possible to go?
I don't think we have a specific mile per year kind of thing. I was struck by something that Mr. Karch said last night about downtown, where they have done 370 feet of sewer replacement and repair in the downtown. And I think many of us who are downtown know that, you know, that took a little while. They still have 8,300 feet to go. And so that gives you an idea that, you know, it could be a few years of very intensive work, particularly in our older parts.
What is your sense of how fast the council does want to move after last night's discussion?
Oh, I think we recognize that this is a primary need. This is something that Mayor Renner has talked about a lot, and we hear a lot from our residents. They want good infrastructure. It all comes from the ground on up. And many of the other things that we want to do in this community, including economic development, you know, rest on what's, you know, our streets and what's underneath our streets. So I think this is very high priority for us.
Is this a pay-as-you-go situation, or would the city bond and then dedicate these increased revenues to that bond?
I would suspect or expect that we would see a good conversation about doing a bond that would enable us not just to do this, but maybe increase the spending for road resurfacing and some other infrastructure needs, sidewalks, that kind of thing.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're with Mayor Pro Tem Karen Schmidt of the City of Bloomington, longtime alderman. Also on the council's discussion agenda is a so-called catalyst project at the site of the Market Street parking garage, a potential new library and Connect Transit Transfer Center. What is your sense of the council's position on that, given that there had been previously a council consensus, largely, on keeping the library where it is?
Well, this is a conversation that came out of some brainstorming with the Downtown Task Force. Of course, what they're doing is to go through, in a detailed way, through our downtown strategy and begin to prioritize the things that will enable us to move ahead most energetically, I think, in the downtown. The idea of it moving to the Market Street garage, I think, caught some people by surprise, many people by surprise. We did have a joint Bloomington Public Library Board meeting, City Council meeting to discuss this, and in our straw poll, we had strong majority consensus among the council to keep the library at its current location. A lot of that has to do with the vision that I think we've heard Mayor Renner lay out over the past few years about, well, we bought the Sugar Creek packing plant, for example. There's been some conversation about a children's library that might be separate but connected to an enlarged main library. There's a detention basin that would need to be built that would provide some, you know, more of a park-like setting. And, of course, moving the public works garage and that whole area has been an ongoing project for city staff. So I think having come to that agreement, you know, in the library board, then going and having an additional meeting and vote to create plans to keep the library at its current location and expand on, I think it caught some people by surprise. There's some interesting synergies that came out of that conversation, thinking about Connect Transit. And, you know, I know that they're very keen to have a transfer station in downtown Bloomington, and that would be certainly an asset for us. I think it was proposed last evening that if we're going to take this change in direction, that we probably need to get the council and the library board back together again, because the library board needs to be able to really put some firm plans in place and begin to talk about how they're going to finance their own enhancement to the building.
Is that the right place for a library? It's downhill a little bit from the rest of downtown. Kids are not going to want to walk uphill to a whole lot to the
I'm not so
to the museum.
That.
Okay. No, you the bicyclist would not be.
Speaking as a mom, I'd be saying, come on, it's a couple blocks. I think, you know, we create our own pathways and our own connections, and I think we've really gotten behind the idea that we want to enhance that section that's south of Olive Street. It's one of the major corridors coming into our downtown, and this seemed like a real opportunity to do that.
Is there anything else around there, though, to build on? That's a relatively bereft area.
Well, that's exactly right, and I think I have to say as a librarian that I'm absolutely delighted that people talk about the library as a catalyst project, and I completely 100% agree on that, and I think that it can be a catalyst right where it is. That's my personal opinion about it, and I think, Austin Grammer pointed out a year or so ago how many people come into the library and the opportunities that kind of visibility and that kind of foot traffic can spur, other kinds of development. So, I think there's a lot to say for it expanding in its present location. That being said, I certainly appreciate the fact that the Market Street Garage is, we're continuing to, to work to keep it in its best possible shape, and that is a key piece of parking for downtown. So, we certainly don't want to lose sight of that and how important that can be.
So are you committed one way or the other, present location or new?
Are you asking me personally?
Yes, as an alderman.
Well, I've already said that I'd like to keep it at its present location and expand on that, as did seven other aldermen, six aldermen and the mayor. So for me, I think we've made the decision, but if there's enough interest in having another conversation, I think we should have that with the library board and do it soon.
Here is another question, too. Is there really another need for a public marker in downtown? There's the BCPA, there's the Coliseum. These had been a hoped-for catalyst for a public-private partnership that would emerge from those two signposts that the city is committed to the downtown. How many more public indicators of support for the downtown would be necessary?
I'm not looking at the library through that.
I'm talking about a new site for the library, rather.
The library needs to expand. Let's take the location out of it. The library is bursting at the seams with people and with books and movies and computer technology, you name it. I think you could argue about that location, and I think that's why the Downtown Task Force, got sort of involved in this, because they were thinking about it in different ways. I don't think about this in probably the same way that I would think about the Coliseum.
So you've said that, quite correctly, that there's been a public expression by seven aldermen and you about the present location of the library. And if there is to be a further conversation, it needs to happen soon. Well, is there a need for it, in your view? And how should it be either fostered as a conversation or put to bed relatively quickly?
Is there a need for what?
A conversation about this proposed catalyst project.
Well, I think if the Downtown Task Force, really has, are excited about this and would like there to be some further consideration about moving the library to a new location, then they deserve the airing and, they deserve a hearing. So, I'd certainly be open to that. I don't think anybody gets anywhere by having a closed mind.
What are they going to have to prove or proffer, rather, to change minds on this?
I don't know. I think that they would have to show a lot of synergies that maybe we haven't considered, and we would also have to reconsider our plans for what we were thinking about from Olive Street on south to Oakland MacArthur.
Alderman Karen Schmidt, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Either the mayor or a city council representative typically joins us the day after a council meeting. Alderman Schmidt, the mayor pro tem, is with us today. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Former Bloomington Mayor Steve Stockton retired from State Farm 13 years ago, but he put some of his experience there to use this past weekend during the assault by Hurricane Irma in Florida. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talked with Stockton just as he finished assessing damage to his condo and the complex where he serves as president in Cocoa Beach, Florida, which was battered by Irma's powerful winds.
Cocoa Beach is on a barrier island. Actually, it's the second barrier island out. There was, I guess, back in early time, one barrier island was established. It's called Merritt Island. And then another barrier island built up. That's Cocoa Beach is on that island. So we have an island in between us and the mainland.
Let's go to when you first learned about Hurricane Irma approaching and what prompted you to decide we're going to leave Bloomington and we are going to drive 18 hours.
Well, to understand why we do a crazy thing like that, you need to know that they persuaded me to be head of our condo association here. And it's not a big condo complex. There's only 64 units. But that doesn't necessarily reduce the responsibility. We came down last year for Hurricane Matthew, and I took the lead in preparations. So when we heard that Irma was going to be heading up the coast, we actually wanted to take a flight on Allegiant, but then they canceled our flight. So we decided the best thing to do is to just drive straight through, which was kind of interesting because we had very little traffic going the direction we were. Everybody was going the other direction. So we're sitting there saying, that makes us feel a little foolish.
Wow. So you first concentrated on stuff for the complex and making sure the complex was protected. What about your own condo?
Well, we tried not to neglect that. Unfortunately, the last time around with Matthew, we kind of ran out of time on our own condo, and there were a couple of things that we wanted to do for ourselves that we didn't get done. This time, we budgeted our time and made sure that we had time to make our own place secure. In the condo itself, obviously there's lowering all the storm shutters, taking more valuable things and putting them in interior rooms in case a window was breached or broken and water came in, and just make sure that you're secure from wind, water, electrical surges. One thing we've learned is get hotel reservations early. Some of our neighbors didn't do that, and then they were having trouble finding places to go. People were driving from Miami and other spots in Florida all the way up into South Davis, Florida, South Carolina, to find a hotel room because everything down here after just a day or two, everything was snapped up.
We're talking with former Bloomington Mayor Steve Stockton, who is still in Florida and hoping to return to Bloomington after checking on his condo and his association in Cocoa Beach, Florida, but rode out the majority of the storm at an airport hotel in Orlando. And you chose that hotel because you'd had good experience with it previously.
So my State Farm experience involved many years ago helping to select hotels for our claims people to stay in a natural disaster. And there's a number of things that you look at. I applied some of that to my own personal use and found a hotel that is fairly new, so it meets a lot of the standards that were set up after Hurricane Andrew for construction. One that was in an area with underground utilities. It's near the airport, right off the main road, so that if we knew that the roads would be open quickly because it, you know, the airport is an important destination. And also look for a place that wasn't too near other buildings so that debris wouldn't come off the other buildings and come into the windows here. So things like that went into the selection of the hotel, and that worked out very well for us because we rode out the storm here, never lost power, had water, had television, had communications, internet, and cell phone. Whereas one of our neighbors went to another hotel and they had some real problems. They lost power, their windows broken in the hotel, and we finally were able to go down to the desk and cajole them into a another room, so our friends moved over here.
Were you able to hear or experience any part of the winds and the storm that was happening outside of your hotel?
Yeah, and that is scary. You know, being from Illinois, we're conditioned to think about when you hear those winds and the window is shaking back and forth and so on, that's a tornado. Here, that's just a normal part of a hurricane, and the true Floridians are used to that. We had all that, both hurricanes we've been through now. It is scary. And you think the window's going to break, and in some cases they do, but we didn't have any problems with that here. The other thing is I had a camera back at the condo, and we were watching and listening to some of our rooms there, and we could hear the noises and the violent pounding and so on as the full first force of the hurricane. We had it focused on, we have a corner unit and there were sliding glass doors on both corners, but those hurricane shutters were getting quite a workout, and you could readily hear it over the, using the microphone of the camera. I looked over the camera and the light all of a sudden went out in the room, and the camera went dead soon thereafter, and I knew that we had lost power. And I went with one of my fellow board members over there today, and the power is still not on. But I will say there were a lot of cars on the road, but there were caravans of trucks, linemen's trucks, all over. And I think some of them were headed down to Miami. We were told here that they brought in 16,000 linemen from outside of Florida through a mutual aid program with the power companies.
Did you run into any difficulty getting from Orlando to Cocoa Beach?
Well, there was quite a bit of traffic at first, and most of that was headed to Miami. So once we got past that, we got out of the stop-and-go traffic on the Beach Line Expressway. Went from there.
How did your condos fare? What kind of damage did you experience there?
Actually, fairly well. Both times with Matthew and this time, we had very little damage. The building has some of these concrete roof tiles on them, and they're hard to keep in place. And when they come down, they come down hard. They probably weigh 5-8 pounds each. We also had air conditioning units on the roof of the building. It's a flat roof. Some of those had been disconnected and had been knocked over, actually ripped from their mounting. The multi-hundred pound units did not go very far. They weren't carried up into the air like in The Wizard of Oz.
So when you compare this storm to Matthew, which is the one that you have experienced previously, and that was pretty devastating to lots of areas, how does this compare? Can you say yet?
Yeah, I would say that in Matthew, the damage was more generalized, and to our particular building, we had a few big things go wrong that I think our total cost for all the buildings was only $8,000, so they couldn't have been too big. But with Irma, most of the damage was within a few blocks of the ocean, and the damage was a lot of little things for the most part. I mean, an air conditioner that is torn off its mounting maybe doesn't seem like a little thing, but compared to what could happen on the beach, that was not a big deal. So we had a lot of, we had some trees that were uprooted. We had lampposts in the parking lot that were bent over. So a lot of little things were in it. It turned out that wind was actually less in our location for Oma than for Matthew, but the damage makes me wonder about that.
So President Trump last month had rescinded an executive order that required flood-damaged property to be rebuilt higher and stronger, and also doing away with federal flood mapping. Do you think that's something that's going to be reversed in light of these two big storms and maybe more to come?
My understanding is that coincidentally they're going to be announcing a new study of flood mapping that could change some of these classifications for the area we're in. It is important to look at where you're building and to assure that if we're finding that we're getting more storms and so on, that even though it's going to cost me personally, I think it's only fair that we be mapped and pay for some of that premium.
Colleen Reynolds spoke with former Bloomington Mayor Steve Stockton about his hurricane experience.
Sometimes on Ask Me Another, our contestants are wrong.
That is incorrect.
Are you kidding me?
Other times, they're so wrong, they're right.
Squirts Illustrated.
Squirts Illustrated is funnier.
It's amazing.
That should have been the answer.
Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia. Ask Me Another, Saturday morning at 10 on GLT, News and Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, reminding families that September is Life Insurance Awareness Month. You can take simple steps today to protect what matters most, from your family to your business. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Heartland Theater presents a wildly popular Victorian comedy of manners that skewers hypocrisy and pomposity in some of the wittiest dialogue ever uttered by actors. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of The Date Book.
Heartland Theater Company in Normal presents Oscar Wilde's comedy, The Importance of Being Earnest. That's running now through September 23rd. Don LaCasse is the director, and Kathleen Kirk is in the cast. She's playing Lady Bracknell. Make no mistake.
I am Lady Bracknell. What more can one desire?
Actually, nothing at this moment. You've just made my morning complete. So we're talking the importance of being earnest. Mm-hmm. And I was really surprised. I'm embarrassed because I have seen this play. I've read the play. I've seen it numerous times. But I didn't realize that there was a second part to the title, which is A Trivial Comedy for Serious People. What was Oscar Wilde saying when he did that?
Well, he's looking at the way Victorian society trivialized institutions like marriage, romance, things of that type. And for serious people, it's because they take themselves very seriously.
First on the program, the little subtitle epigram was the opposite.
Really?
A serious comedy for trivial people. And the theater management said no. And he switched it around.
A
kind of sarcastic, satirical, ironic commentary or even didacticism might have been part of his impulse. You know, show you what you are. Show the society what they are. And they laughed. They saw what they were, and they thought it was hilarious. Opening night was a great success, followed by some
by some unpleasantness. Oh, poor Oscar and that poor trial.
Yes.
Which was such a trial.
Well, actually, when he first contested in a defamation suit and he lost it, the theater took his name off the program.
Yeah. And and actually, it didn't run for much longer afterwards.
Didn't. Once he was convicted.
83 performances. Yep. That's all it had, and that first run.
And it's a classic of English comedic theater.
Yeah. Yes. It took a few years before it started appearing again, and then it's been a staple part of the repertoire now for years.
So why is it such a staple? I mean, there's been a lot of drama that came out of the Victorian era. Why this play?
Well, I think it has incredible wit. The language is absolutely beautiful. I think the characters are well-drawn and interesting to watch. And, of course, the character that's most people think of with the play is Lady Bracknell.
Hello, Lady Bracknell.
Hello.
Tell us about Lady Bracknell.
Yes.
I do think she takes herself seriously and earnestly. The earnest aspect kind of is a theme underlying everything.
Mm-hmm.
She is a self-assured person, which I personally am not. So that's quite a challenge. And she observes all the social conventions and wants a good marriage for her daughter. And she's also got her eye on her nephew, who has run up a lot of debts. And so their family could be harmed by scandal or trouble if she doesn't keep everything together. So she wants to make a good match for her daughter. I think she's almost given up on Algernon in that regard.
You know, looking at this character, I sometimes wonder if Julian Fellowes was inspired by Lady Bracknell when he created the character of the Dowager Countess in Downton Abbey, because she has that sort of same sort of acerbic, observational, concerned about appearances kind of thing going on.
And she's the law on what they should do and shouldn't do.
She observes in the lines and in her relationships with others that this is the surface. This is a social convention, and it is conventions that keep society together. There's stuff running under the surface. Part of her subtext would be, that exists, that's fine, you can do that. But you have to observe the conventions or everything will fall apart.
Don, tell me why you wanted to direct this show.
Oh, heavens, I've always loved this show. And again, I think for me, the opportunity to do a language play is very exciting. And a space such as Heartland, to me, is a perfect venue
for doing
language plays, because you can hear the language. And the intimacy of the space, I think, just enhances the language and the characters. As you hear the play, you're going to recognize things that you've heard before, that you may not have known where that came from.
Oh.
It's just like Shakespeare.
Yeah.
In that you'll hear so many of the sayings we use today, Shakespeare either created or at least popularized it in his time.
So the suspense is terrible. I hope it will last, that sort of thing, from our old pal Oscar.
Right.
Yes.
So the importance of being earnest is, earnest is more than just a guy in this play. Let's talk about the importance of the name Ernest and the word Ernest and how Ernest is used in this play.
That is very complicated.
It is.
Well, it has to do with the two males having another identity. Algernon, he created Bunbury so that this allows him to go to the country whenever he wants, because he uses Bunbury's illnesses, which he gets sick all the time, supposedly, as a way to get away from the city, an excuse.
So he has this fake sick friend.
Right. Mm-hmm. Bunbury. And then Jack, from the country, when he comes to the city, he's created Ernest, so that he claims he has this brother Ernest who is always getting in trouble, and that he has to constantly go to London to bail him out. And what happens eventually is that both of the young women they are pursuing, one lives in a country and one in the city, they are enamored of the name Ernest. And
because it's just so dependable.
They just love the name Ernest.
Okay, silly girls.
And that leads to many complications.
I think it's interesting how Wilde has created these characters who have these other identities. And that's something that Oscar Wilde had to live every day of his life.
He
had to live a double life, one of which he had to keep secret from society, which, and when it came out, it came out very badly indeed.
I'm not even sure how secret he was about it, because he was tremendously flamboyant.
With the green carnation and all that.
Yes, the way he dressed and the way he spoke.
But he couldn't openly say, hey,
that's
I'm
right.
a gay man.
That's right.
And that's where I think probably his mother, you know, okay, you are what you are, but you must maintain the social conventions. And that part of Lady Bracknell is part of the play, too.
This ended up being his last play because he was put in prison for 2 years and he was bankrupt. And after he got out of prison, he went to France and he died there. And he said he could write more plays, but he just didn't feel
The heart of it had gone out of him and not wanting to do that.
Yeah. And we're doing the script that he revised and refined for publication.
Yes.
So it opened in 1895 and he prepared it for publication in 1899.
Actually, he gave the theater manager at St. James Theater this copy of the play, which is a four-act play.
Right.
And the manager told Wilde that he felt it was too long. So they ended up cutting one or two characters out of the play, and he turned it into a three-act play rather than a four-act.
And that's the one he developed for publication.
Yeah, and that's the one we're using.
Yeah.
So what does a group of word-obsessed, clever Victorians have to say to us today?
Well,
mind your P's and Q's.
Yes.
Although that's not in this play.
And I think you will find a surprising number of comments in the play to be rather feminist.
Really?
I think it's kind of fascinating. The roles of men, where they should be. Gwendolyn talks about her father. She says that my father is Lord Bracknell, and Cecily, who she's talking to, is, well, she doesn't know who that is. She says, well, I'm happy to say that outside of the family house, he's completely unknown. But I think the home is where he should be.
Okay.
To paraphrase.
While Lady Bracknell conforms to all of the social conventions and that a young girl can't do things by herself, she herself is a woman making all the arrangements. Her husband is home sick, and so she's doing everything that otherwise the man would do.
Well, the poor guy,
if
she has a dinner party and she has 13, he has to go upstairs and have his dinner up there.
That's director Don LaCasse and actress Kathleen Kirk. Heartland Theater Company presents Oscar Wilde's comedy, The Importance of Being Earnest, now through September 23rd at the theater at 1 Normal Plaza. I'm Laura Kennedy.
This is Sound Ideas. Heartland Theater is hosting a post-show panel discussion about Oscar Wilde and his work after the Sunday, September 17th matinee. The president's popularity is at an all-time low. A special prosecutor is looking into Russian collusion during the election, and the president's combative relationship with Congress continues. Covering all of it as NPR's national political correspondent is GLT's 2017 Radio Faces guest Don Gagne. Tickets and tables for GLT's Radio Faces November 10th are available now. Learn more at WGLT.org. You're listening to Times Have Changed, the title track to the latest album by Chicago's Ronnie Baker Brooks. He performed Saturday at the Elnora Guitar Festival in Urbana. Brooks tells GLT's John Norton via Skype that for the recording of this album, he left his guitar pedals at home.
I plugged straight into the amp through a Gibson guitar. That was an adjustment for me at first, mentally. I've done it before playing live, but maybe one or two tracks I've done it recording. But usually I had some, like when I'm doing my solos or whatever, I have some kind of distortion or some kind of pedal effect on it. And for this record, it was just straight into the amp, man. And it was, all the distortion you hear is just from the amp.
What does your body, what does your mind feel when you hear the guitar coming back at you a different way? Do you just go, God, this doesn't sound right? Or, I mean, how does it throw you off your game at first?
Well, at first, you got to mess around with it. You got to get comfortable with what you're hearing and adjust to the track that you're playing to. And what you hear back from the amplifier definitely reflects on what you play. And what you're hearing back from the track as well, it reflects on what you play. So I just tried to get into the track and play with a little more soul.
So in a way, would it be fair to say that was a crutch of yours that you had to break?
It could have been. I grew up with, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Jimi Hendrix, Carlos Santana, the rock stuff. And you're hearing the distortion. And
sure.
Whereas with the blues, B.B. King and Freddie King and Albert King, they basically just went straight to the amp, man. And a lot of the distortion that you heard probably was just from the amp being cranked. But basically what you heard was them playing with their fingers straight into an amplifier. So it was cool, but I wouldn't say it was a crutch. It's just a different approach to recording.
Okay. Is there an example you could use on Times Have Changed? Is there any way to explain through one of the songs that are on the album?
Well, the song I did with Bobby Blue Bland, Old Love, it's an Eric Clapton, Robert Cray song. And I had luckily enough to have Bobby Blue Bland sing on the record with me. I played that record, that song, live many times before I've recorded it for this record. And normally I would have distortion and get like a Ernie Isley thing on it, like Ernie Isley from the Isley Brothers, or like a Hendrix thing. And whereas this one, it was more just straight, clean approach. So I just relied on soul and just what I felt at the time. Opposed to, if you listen to The Torch, you may listen to On the Other Side of Love, it's real distorted. I think it's a growth thing too, man. It's just basically getting comfortable with what you're hearing back, what you're playing. I trusted Steve Jordan, our producer. That was the first thing he said was, leave the pedal boards on the bus. So that was, it was a great, great challenge for me. And I'm glad that I went through it. And I believe it made me a better musician, especially my approach to playing.
When I'm lying in bed, it's just too much confusion. Well, going around in my head.
The song you're hearing is Old Love. It's on the most recent album by our guest, Ronnie Baker Brooks. Times Have Changed is the name of the album, and this is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Well, Bobby Blue Bland just passed away. You must have got him for your album not long before he passed away.
Yeah, we cut the record with him back in January of 2013, and then he passed that June. And I talked to his son, Rod DeBland, and his wife, Willie Mae, and they said that was the last thing that he recorded. Wow. That's what Rod told me.
Wow.
Fortunately, I got it on record, but unfortunately, that was the last song. And also the last song recorded with my father was Twine Time. And my father passed away in April. So, we had a couple of people that passed away when we started, before the end of the recording this record. And I talked to Steve Jordan about that, and he was like, well, you have the legacy record. And that helped me get over the emotional part of it, and understand that I'm blessed to have these great icons grace the record with me.
Twine is the name of the song. It's featuring Lonnie Brooks, the father of our guest, Ronnie Baker Brooks. You and I met face-to-face in 2003 when you played down here in Bloomington at the Nothing But the Blues Festival. And you talked about your father at that time, and you mentioned what a no-nonsense guy he was as a father when you were growing up. But he also talked about the qualities that he instilled in you as a professional, because you played with your father for many years, and you played, obviously, on your own as well. What are some of those intangibles? What are some of those qualities that your father, and maybe your mother, too, instilled into you professionally that, boy, you're really glad that you have now?
Well, growing up, John, the first thing both parents taught me was to respect others. Just respect others. And dad applied that teaching towards the band. You respect your bandmates, you respect your band, you treat them as you want them to be treated, as you want it to be treated. And you take care of the hands that take care of you. And that was one of the intangibles I would call it, because if you be around my dad, if you were around my dad, you saw these things and how he handled each person. You got maybe six or seven different personalities, and you handle each person within their personality and keep them on the same page on being in band and or creating music or in a studio, whatever the situation comes to be. And I learned that from watching Dad on how he handled and always stayed professional, even with me being his son, where it was times where I stepped out of the box and it wasn't right, and he had to check me and say, hey, son, that's not right. And he handled that professional. And that was definitely one of the intangibles of running the band. And, you know, he allowed me to see how it was done from the ground up, from creating the music, preparing, creating a good work ethic, to take care of the business, to the whole thing. So I'm blessed, and I would not be able to do what I'm doing today the way I'm doing it today if it wasn't for my dad, Lonnie Brooks.
For those that don't know, Lonnie Brooks is considered a blues legend, and not just a Chicago blues legend, but a blues legend. And Ronnie is your son. You described the behind-the-scenes stuff. What do you think is his legacy in the blues?
My dad was different. He was just different musically, his personality. He was a fun guy. He always liked to have fun. He always had a smile on his face. His music, it has so many different styles infused in it, where it became his own little sound, basically. I remember you spoke of Bruce Iglar. I remember when he first started recording with Bruce Iglar, and he came up with these songs, and they were rehearsing for these sessions, and Dad was playing this stuff, and it was like it was like Chinese arithmetic at first, like, what the hell is this? Uh-huh. But then it came into this thing, man, and you could feel this energy, and I was around it. Matter of fact, I was helping him create some of that stuff on the early Alligator stuff. Didn't know what I was doing, John. I was just playing around with the guitar. My dad was just wise enough to listen to what I was doing. And he always said, you can learn something from anybody. You can learn something from a child. Hmm. And I was very young, just, picking up the instrument. And of course, I'm going to play something that probably never been heard before, because I hadn't heard anything previously.
And you didn't know what the rules were probably either. So you, right?
Right. And my dad was smart enough to grab all that, man, and just put it into a song, man. And it just became a different thing for him. And the sound, he was playing this SG guitar. He was plugged straight into an amp as well. And he had a different approach to it, whereas back then a lot of the artists were playing the 1-4-5 style, or the traditional Chicago blues, where my dad had the Louisiana funk in it, he had the Zydeco in it, he had the rock and roll, because he was a rock and roll guy from Texas as well, and then he had the blues too, and soul music. He was doing soul for Chess. He did a soul recording for Chess. So all these different elements was in his music, and it just made him different to me. As I've gotten older and listened to the other artists now, I see the difference, and totally now, whereas before I was just in it, I didn't know the difference, and I'm just blessed that I was around all of that stuff at a very, very early age, man.
I want you to show me a man out there that's got a good woman. Show me. Show me a man that's got a good woman. Show me a man that's got a good woman. Show me a man that's got a good woman. Show me a man that's got a good woman. Show me a man that's got a good woman. I show you a man that'll go to work humming. He knows he's got some good loving coming. The end.
Chicago bluesman Ronnie Baker Brooks talked via Skype with GLT's John Norton. Brooks performs Saturday night at the Elnora Guitar Festival in Urbana.
Show me a woman that's got a good man. Show me a woman that's got a good man. Show me a woman that's got a good man. Show me a woman that's got a good man. Show me a woman that's got a good man. I'll show you a woman doing all she can to make life worth living for her good man.
You're listening to WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University. You can find us on the web at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews from John Norton, Laura Kennedy, and Colleen Reynolds. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag @SoundIdeas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Show me. Show me two people in love with each other. Show me two people in love with each other. Show me two people in love with each other. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.